Welcome to Main Street on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein. My colleague and co-host Ashley Thornburg remains on vacation. Coming up in the second half of today's show, our news director, Dave Thompson, tells us about a new newsletter he's publishing. It pulls from his 40 years of experience covering North Dakota news. And of course, we'll review this week's headlines with Dave as well. Madeline also stops by. He reviews the movie Cabrini and talks about the Oscars. But first, we turn to a recent episode of Conversations on Healthcare. Dr. Jody Halpern is a psychiatrist, noted author, and co-founder of the University of California Berkeley Group for Ethics and Regulation of Innovative Technologies. Research shows that 26% of adult Americans have a diagnosable mental health situation each year, and private industry is rushing to provide AI tools and bots to help patients navigate these issues. However, Dr. Halpern explains there are ethical issues and problems that are arising from the marketing of these services. This episode was hosted by Margaret Flintner and Mark Maselli, who begins by wondering if apps people are using today even work.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
We want our audience to have a better understanding about what apps and kind of technology are we talking about, and does the research show they work?
First of all, in my work, I'm not just looking at apps that call themselves mental health apps, because in order to avoid any very expensive requirements of going through FDA approval, the majority of apps that people are using for mental health are not called mental health apps. They're called wellness apps or even companionship apps. So most of what we know come from those apps rather than from the few more recent mental health companies. And let me say a few things, because I know that you both, your group has interviewed many people on digital health more generally. I'm specifically talking about therapy bots that replace psychiatrists, psychotherapists. There's a lot of work in digital health that you've covered on your show, and the use of AI for medical records, the use of AI for diagnostics, and mental health, as in other parts of medicine, is a whole different thing that's well underway and quite advanced and showing a lot of promise. But the very new thing in just the past few years, because of the loneliness and mental health crisis, both in this country and the world, which is really something that needs attention, is that there are people who see this as a big business opportunity and have been developing AI-related services, especially bots, and now increasingly we'll talk about how they operate, to provide mental health services. What we know is we have very little data on the empirical outcome of using a bot and no human for your mental health care. Using, again, AI-assisted care, using digital mental health, the biggest study just came out in Nature last week that used actually AI machine learning to analyze outcomes in digital mental health. That's when people basically send digital messages to a genuine human, and they do therapy through messaging. And that we have data showing can be effective. So, and this study, which JAMA just put out, had 166,000 clients. And so, you know, if you have a real therapist that you contact in a digital way, just through text messaging, that may be helpful on a regular basis with anxiety, with mild to moderate depression. That seems like the fact that there is another human there and you know it, there seems to be effectiveness there. Mm-hmm. And of course, you both also know from all your work that using Zoom for therapy during COVID, I mean, we have a lot of that data and that has been effective as well. Mm-hmm. But I'm specifically targeting this big business investment, $6.5 billion in expected profits in using bots to replace humans and therapists. That's what I'm specifically writing a book about, engineering empathy, and focusing on and doing research on, because that's the new big area. I will say one other thing. I mentioned the mental health and loneliness crisis. In this country, we know from a Harvard study that came out in 2022 that 36% of all Americans suffer from extreme loneliness, mm-hmm. and 61% of young people, mm-hmm. and 51% of young mothers with young children. That's a huge amount of extreme loneliness. We know that there's been a worldwide 25% increase in serious mental health issues, serious depression and anxiety, And that kind of increase worldwide statistically is just unbelievable. Like if we cured the three largest cancers in the US, we would only get a 2% change in mortality. So to have a worldwide increase of 25% in mental health diagnoses is astounding. So there is a huge reason that we care about getting to many more people. And we also know, and you've covered, that access to care is very limited. So I understand very much the need to use technology. The question is how best to use it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could just speak maybe for a moment about the degree to which we're looking at this with children and adolescents, this possibility of these alternative technologies, as well as adults. Any particular concerns there? Is there as much research going on with children and adolescents as there is with adults?
That's great. I'm glad you asked me that, because that's the area that got me to really become more of an advocate and get involved in doing press interviews, is my concern about what is happening regarding children. So I said 61% of adolescents and young adults, we have that data now, suffer from extreme loneliness in the United States, 2/3. And the only country with data like that is South Korea. What does the US and South Korea have in common? Our children spend 8 to 10 hours a day on online social activities. This is in addition to doing their homework online. So they basically are either gaming or on social media, as far as I can tell, every minute they're awake. I mean, unless they're really not sleeping. So
also a problem.
Well, no, it's related. It's extremely related, because a lot of my work has been showing how as a psychiatrist who's also studied neuroscience, the mechanisms that social media for-profit companies, all the large companies, which any two of which have more money, and the seven largest companies, media companies, digital companies, mm-hmm. Google, Meta, et cetera, any two of them have equivalent money to the whole federal government. Mm-hmm. So their power to determine and keep us from having regulation is very, very large. So we're the most unregulated country compared to Europe and some of the Asian countries that have anything like our scope. And one of the things that the UK did years ago was regulate marketing to children for social media and gaming, and the technology that gets kids addicted, which is irregular rewards. It's the same thing that gets us addicted. In fact, Instagram uses it, which most people don't know. Instagram doesn't, every time you put up something, a picture, it doesn't just give you back your likes. It saves them up in bundles and gives them to you irregularly, the way slot machines work in Las Vegas. And that technology, which we saw the patents for 10 years ago and started talking about then, that develops dopamine surges that get you addicted. So the fact that we're all addicted to our phones, addicted to social media, and addicted to gaming is not accidental. It's not accidental. It's the marketing model of those companies. And I am seeing the same marketing model in the relational support bots for children. And so that is what concerns me, because it's one thing to say we need to get mental health resources that use technology into the schools for kids. We do. We do need to help kids, and kids are comfortable with technology. So if we have ways of them connecting with real humans or other kids, or using some online technologies that I'll describe that don't make you addicted in the same way, mm-hmm. that would all be very useful. But we actually have a good series of reviews by business reviewers, including the Harvard Business School has a letter that's very in-depth from an engineering and business expert on how one of the most important mental health companies that has gone through the FDA and is held up as a role model, how their business model is giving the app free to kids in schools, the app that just has a bot. You never talk to a human, because it's, quote, a sticky technology, and therefore children will get used to going to a bot rather than a human for mental health, and they'll grow up to be adults who are used to only using bots. And so it's a very good business model for a company. So there's a for-profit motive in getting this, even from very professionally endorsed companies that are for-profit, if they are for-profit mm-hmm. in the mental health sphere.
To some degree or another, there are a group of people who think generative AI is a ray of innovation, but we're in an early stage, right? And it will get more sophisticated, it will get more user-centric. And obviously it's not a magic wand. We have issues on data privacy and informed consent, on bias mitigation and the like. But if it were nonprofits who were doing this, or are there any examples of nonprofits who have entered this field? I can't help but think there must be social entrepreneurs who are thinking about this technology to do good and to design it. So anything on the horizon? I obviously understand your focus on there are some bad actors whose intentions are to hook people in it. But it seems that there is a shortage of behavioral health providers. Also, we're looking at the data sets that most half of the behavioral health providers have some burnout associated with them. So we have a paucity of providers, and we have this enormous, you laid out the numbers very nicely, numbers of people who are impacted who need support. So I guess I'm trying to figure out, do you see any roadmap? I think you're trying to lay out the guardrails, hopefully in your book, and I want to hear more about the book, but guardrails about, hey, be careful here. But is there a pathway, perhaps, for using this technology in a progressive and supportive way?
Definitely, definitely. And I did start out with, in a way, the concerns of the business models that we currently do not regulate. And really, it's not, by the way, I don't even think it's bad actors. I think it's the way the United States compares to Europe in our lack of a regulatory standard. And seeing regulation as negative as opposed to helping to cut my field. We also started a Kavli Center at Berkeley for Science, Technology, and Ethics, where we work with scientists and engineers and show how good regulation actually can further the good use and the further development and advancement of technology for good purposes. So that's what my whole life is actually devoted to, is finding out how to use the best cutting edge science and technology to go forward. But I will say that in the UK, there's been excellent regulation, which has allowed already for better uses. And one of the main uses in the UK, as we all know, large language models like ChatGPT, they only emerge onto the scene about a year ago, which is amazing because they've influenced so much already. Machine learning was influencing other of these products for many years. But the National Health Service is the first to institute on their a large scope of calls that come in for primary care appointments. They are using a large language model to listen in with the provider on the call, because we all know that people in health know about 75% of primary care visits, people might have a mental health need, and they're very often undetected because people don't come right in and say, I'm depressed or I'm suffering from really severe anxiety. So, and as humans, because doctors and nurses and primary care providers are so busy, and because of burnout being so high, also over 50%, we miss a lot. We all miss a lot. I mean, the thing is, there's nothing perfect about human providers, to say the least. And so having AI listen in with and use large language models to detect depression and anxiety is a wonderful use potentially. Yeah. I just want to say one thing. Also, my opinions on the evidence that exists about what might be harmful or what might be good, the most important thing we need, and it's what I'll talk about before we finish today, is we need to require post-marketing research in all of these things, which the FDA, I'm very involved in the fields of gene editing and neurotechnology as well. Those are the three arms of the institute we co-founded: neurotechnology, gene editing, and AI, and the histories of regulation in these different fields and helping advance them. And what we're seeing is a real lag in AI. And but for gene editing, we have post-marketing research requirements, because some of the things that can emerge with gene editing, you just can't know in a 1 or 2 year trial. And that's definitely true for AI because it's changing so rapidly. So I think that, you know, if we had the kind of post-marketing research attached to even it doesn't necessarily have to be only public entities that create these services, but if they were regulated as all kinds of private entities that do research in this country are regulated, medical research are regulated by Congress to have IRBs, which are these institutional review boards that I've said we should have for AI. We should have AIRBs, where we have It could be a private entity or a public entity, but if they're doing something highly innovative that we don't know how it'll affect people because it's changing rapidly and we are changing rapidly, we should have requirements for post-marketing safety research findings to be publicized. Right. So I don't think it's so much bad actors as that the US has always lags compared to Europe in regulation.
Right.
And I think everyone who goes to a doctor these days knows, or a nurse knows, they don't look us in the eyes because they're so nervous about getting everything on the record. And I really care about burnout, especially after COVID. Many of my dear medical students, I've been training the most empathic medical students, and I've worked with some nurse practitioners through the years who are the most empathic providers you could ever meet, and they are burned out. So if we could help just use large language models to do the medical records, just that alone would be a huge, huge positive change.
You know, I want to ask you about something that I think is, you know, it pops up, it's bothersome. Is it urban legend or is it real? You know, can bots go rogue, advise people to harm themselves or others? And I think maybe more an issue from my point of view is, can they detect that somebody is at risk of hurting themselves or hurting others through language? And is there a system to alert beside, you know, hang up and call 911, which is not always going to be the right answer? Tell us a little bit about that, and how much assurance do we have that this is part of what the tech companies are looking at making sure they've got control of?
Margaret, you and I are totally on the same wavelength. You just basically described the exact set of concerns I have, which is not the rogue examples, which I'll go over. There are some rogue examples, and we can. There's times where the large language models have crazy and told people to kill themselves. And one man in Belgium did, and his wife, who has they have young children, is suing that company. We've seen there was an anorexia website where the large language model was put onto the site and immediately went rogue with certain folks and told them how to lose more weight. So large language models are still early enough, and this was actually 6 months ago, they're young enough in their technological development that some of them have glitched and done these crazy things. But we also unfortunately know that, you know, mental health, there's some awful mental health providers, although at least they lose their license if they do terrible things. But it's not so much the dramatic rare glitches, it's the everyday problem, which is incredible to me, which is that none of the mental health services that I have reviewed, and I could definitely be missing ones, but I'm talking about the actual ones that call themselves mental health providers and that are FDA involved in FDA approvals. They basically, as soon as a person mentions suicidality, they basically sign off and tell you to call 911. And it drives me crazy because we don't have the data yet, but there's gotta be high risk to people because of that. So one of my biggest pet peeves is that those companies need to do something more of a warm handoff at that point. But one thing, and this has to do with the marketing, which we can talk about more or less, they market to people as your trusted companion, your empathic. One reason I got involved is because I study empathy. And people ask me, are they really empathic? No, they're not really empathic. They're machines that simulate language. But they feel useful to people, and they're marketed as your most trusted companion, your therapist, who you can really rely on. People do really rely on them. And then they talk about suicidality, and they're dumped. So my number one thing isn't the dramatic, there'll be lawsuits for the dramatic cases, but it's going to be a very big problem. That's why post-market research is so important. We need to know what happens to those people. And I really can't feel comfortable with them not having actual human handoffs at those points.
Doctor, you're an expert in ethics, and I think most of us saw the highlights of the recent Senate hearing with social media executives. And the accusations were really jarring. They are accused of promoting pedophilia, among other things. You live and work in the Bay Area, which is the center of that tech industry. I'm wondering if you have a sense of the tech sector having a heart, and does it have the ethics it abides to?
Well, first of all, let me say that about those hearings were very painful because there were families there who've lost their children, which any of us who have raised a child or have not, it just is, it's heartbreaking. I have not studied the extent of pedophilia and things like that, but the point I brought up much earlier about most of these sites being engineered to create addiction is a big cause of children becoming more isolated and suffering from worse depression. So I do think that the social media and gaming sites, no matter, you know, whether they have terrible things like pedophilia or just everyday gaming and social media, they're using that dopamine releasing irregular reward system that makes a child or adolescent addicted. And those addiction models then prevent the child from having enough real life time that might be helpful for their mental health. So that's the way I think about the risks of those companies, which are very serious, I think. But in terms of a positive future of, like, how do we make sure tech has empathy, has a heart, has ethics? That's what I'm devoting my life to at this point. So we have two things. You mentioned one group that I've been involved in, co-founded at Berkeley. But the bigger thing we did is we created a center, an international center now, the Kavli Center for Ethics, Science, and the Public. And we have these three areas of science and technology, neurotechnology, gene editing, and AI. And we have 10 fellows in our first year that started, but they're here about a year and a half now. And these are postdoctoral researchers or senior graduate researchers, students and postdocs who are, several of them are in AI. They are the engineers that will develop the new technology or in neurotech or gene editing. And they have choose to do this fellowship with us so that they have built-in professional commitments to thinking about the societal, public, and ethical implications of their work. And our idea is to create a cohort of people like this and to grow it and grow it and grow it. And that's what I'm devoting my time to now, is trying to develop people who, from the very beginning of their professional formation as engineers, have this as part of being a good engineer.
Can you tell us a little bit about the book you're working on right now?
Well, I'm early in the stages of the book, Engineering Empathy, and I've covered some of the things that we're looking at, but I'm particularly interested in, some of it has to do with having studied empathy itself in clinical care for 30 years. I'm very aware of what helps patients and what doesn't. And, you know, what I've come up with through the years in various research studies, sometimes in collaboration with neuroscientists, sometimes in collaboration with medical educators or sociologists, is a very robust model of empathic curiosity in care, that what patients really want is their doctor or nurse to listen to them and see them as an individual with particular and specific hopes and fears. And what's interesting to me is that AI can, with large language models, simulate some of that. Mm-hmm. So some of what I'm studying is, what are the therapeutic benefits of having that simulated? What are the limitations of it? Another thing that I'm studying, which is a little bit off topic for today, but it's relevant, I think, to things that you cover, is, and it's relevant to burnout and clinicians, actually. We've done the research. We did big analysis after COVID. There were so many causes of burnout during COVID, but a huge cause of chronic burnout that was worsened is what we talked about, which is doctors not getting to really make eye contact or clinicians with patients. And what we've shown is that that actually makes practice less meaningful for the clinician, that they are burning out in part because they need to be empathic with patients to find their work meaningful.
That's right.
I mean, I say it like it's a huge discovery. You're both nodding because you both are great in the clinical realm, so you know this is true. So one of the concerns I have is what's happening to the clinicians when they do other things, but when they're not providers of empathy. And then a big concern that's the bigger one is, what happens to us as a society when empathy becomes something we can just easily outsource? Does it become like Google Maps, where none of us have a sense of direction? Do we all lose our empathic curiosity about each other? So some of the topics that I'm interested in.
That was a conversation with Dr. Jodi Halpern, a psychiatrist, noted author, and co-founder of the University of California's Berkeley Group for Ethics and Regulation of Innovative Technologies, on our recent Conversations on Healthcare, a show that features in-depth discussions on health policy and innovation with industry newsmakers from around the globe. More Main Streets ahead.
Hi, I'm Dave Thompson. I've been a regional news reporter on Prairie Public for more than 40 years. I've lived only two places in my life, Grand Forks and Bismarck, but I'm very familiar with the state of North Dakota. I think that helps me because I have the innate understanding of what happens in North Dakota and how people here react to it. When I'm producing a news story, I'm looking for A, the importance of the story, but B, I'm looking for people who can tell the story. And it's more important that I'm just kind of the facilitator for it, and that I'm interviewing people who can actually tell you the story, talk about the issue, and tell you how important it is. I believe in public radio journalism, we try to get more to the heart of the matter, and we try to present as many sides as possible of what's going on. I think that's very valuable. So listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In just a moment, Matt Olien will stop by. He'll review the 2024 movie Cabrini that explores the life of a Catholic missionary focusing on her charity and business efforts in New York City facing sexism and anti-Italianism. Dave, it's a movie I want to see. We welcome in now Dave Thompson. He's our news director here at Prairie Public. How are you, Dave?
I'm doing very well, and you're right. I'd like to see that movie, too. It sounds very interesting.
Matt also is going to run down his Oscar, I guess, review, and we'll see how he did with all of his picks that he made last week. And the spoiler alert, he did pretty well. All right, Dave, you have a new newsletter that's hitting the streets. What should we know about that?
What I'm presenting is some of the things that I've seen in my 40 plus years in covering politics in North Dakota and how it relates, you know, as we're coming up in the political conventions. That's where we're starting right now. For example, we're going to be talking about some of the things that happened at conventions and some of the candidates who decided to skip the conventions. And it started with the idea, do conventions matter? And I think you can argue either way. I think they do matter in terms of trying to promote party unity. And we see the Democrats, you know, doing that more than the Republicans. But the Republicans have people who said, we're going to skip the convention. We'll go and run on the primary ballot. And that's not necessarily a new idea, but you've seen a lot more who said, we're not going to sign any pledge that we will support the actual nominee out of the convention, which has caused some consternation in the party.
I also remember you visiting about how candidates are announcing their elections. That's really changed in your tenure here at Prairie.
Yeah, and in a way, it's very sad to me. And yeah, this is speaking from a personal perspective. I like to go to a place where a candidate has a bunch of supporters and there's some kind of energy in the room and there's some applause and people are talking. A lot of candidates now are just going online and announcing online. And yeah, that's fine. But, you know, there's a little human part of the announcements that you kind of miss.
Well, I'll be looking forward to your newsletter, Dave, and congratulations on that effort. I think that our listeners will appreciate it as well. Let's get into the news this week, Dave. Mm-hmm. Bismarck State College now is looking at a new four-year degree program, and you're working on that story.
Right. And a change in a policy that talks about what colleges can and cannot do. Bismarck State College has been normally a two-year degree college, but they were given permission to do four-year, what they called Bachelor of Applied Science degrees. And now they're looking at expanding it to maybe have some Bachelor of Science degrees that are offered there too. The argument is Bismarck-Mandan Statistical Metropolitan Area is the second largest in the state, and we don't have a four-year public school. So they're saying, hey, there's a lot of need for training in certain things like AI or some machining or some things that, even nursing, they're talking about things like that. And maybe Bismarck State could offer some of those programs. Well, this is a second discussion before a committee of the Board of Higher Education. And in the first one, it didn't go real well. But the second one, they're saying, well, maybe this is a part of an overarching thing that the Board of Higher Education is doing called Envision 2035. Chancellor Hagerod is pushing that. What is the college system going to look like in North Dakota in 10 years? That's what he's looking at. It's a strategic planning effort. And he said these are questions that might be better in front of that committee as well.
Dave, the Wyoming legislature tackled similar issues over the years. And I noticed that initially, when the community colleges wanted to have these bachelors of applied science degrees, the University of Wyoming was saying a little bit kind of under the radar, this is our territory, stay in your lane, community colleges. Essentially, any of that pushback from the 4 years here in North Dakota?
Absolutely. There is some concern about siphoning students from four-year universities to go to Bismarck State College. And I know there is some concern just because of the enrollment situation overall, and that they said this might exacerbate some of the problems at some of the four-year institutions. So I think there's going to have to be a kind of a real overall look at the system and to see, you know, who does what and why, and whether there are going to be partnerships between two-year colleges and four-year colleges. We'll see what happens. But there's a lot of discussion about higher education. And of course, there are some outside threats with the North Star effort in Minnesota in terms of tuition, and that could hurt some of the colleges and universities along the Red River Valley. That's all kind of playing into it. It's kind of an interesting dynamic right now in higher education.
I look forward, Dave, to more of your reporting about that. Staying with the college theme here, North Dakota State College of Science is expanding its precision ag program. Your reporter, Todd McDonald, talked about that.
A good story on that. And they saw a niche at NDSES and said, okay, we can work with the Grand Farm, which is a part of NDSU too, and provide this type of education, this type of training. And precision agriculture is a big, big effort within agriculture right now.
Dave, good story. There's a new state park that's opening in North Dakota.
Yeah, this is the one that's up at Walhalla. It's called the Pimento Gorge State Park. The legislature approved it, and now sometime, probably this spring, they're going to have a groundbreaking to start construction on what they're going to say 50 RV parking spots, 6 cabins, and they're going to have more primitive camping sites there. In talking with our Parks and Recreation Director, he said one of the real beauties of this is it's probably the largest forest in North Dakota. People who have been to the Pimento Gorge, and I will admit I'm one of those people who have not been to the Pimento Gorge yet, but people who have been to the gorge say it looks like it's not part of North Dakota. It's different, but it's beautiful in its own respect. Parks is talking about partnering with other things up there like the Frostfire ski area and some of the other attractions there to get people to northeastern North Dakota.
Dave, two questions about the next story I want to ask you about. The Emergency Commission has okayed $3.4 million of loans from the Bank of North Dakota for the Christmas ice storms. First, what is the North Dakota Emergency Commission?
The North Dakota Emergency Commission is to take care of money that comes in from federal sources, like we talked about the loan there. That's the state's share of the FEMA money coming in for that ice storm at Christmas. Now, it takes care of potential money that comes into North Dakota and how is it allocated. They have to go through a process like that. On that committee, you've got the governor, the attorney general, secretary of state, and then you have legislative leaders, the majority leaders, and the chairman of the appropriations of the House and Senate committee, and they take a look at the overall thing. And most often it is pass-through money, but there's been a few areas of concern. This one, because it's a disaster, it went through pretty easily.
Brings a total of almost $30 million now that has come to the state to help mitigate damage from those Christmas ice storms.
Yeah, can you believe they think at one point 2,500 power poles were down? So we've had an ice storm, really. We haven't seen one of those in a while. So.
Yeah, we forget those things when it's been so nice. Absolutely. As it's been this past winter. Dave, the North Dakota Commission on Legal Counsel for Indigents has set before a legislative committee. They're saying it's really getting tougher for them to hire attorneys.
I think that's an overall thing that I've heard from county state's attorney that they're having problems as well, that people are going to private practice because it pays more. In Burleigh County, for example, let's just take that in. If you're going to become a member, an attorney with the Legal Counsel for Indigents, you can make $70,000 a year. If you go to work for Burleigh County, you make $90,000 a year. So you know that there's a whole kind of dynamic here about A, there aren't enough people to go around, B, they're competing not only with counties, but with other states in keeping these lawyers in North Dakota.
It's a math equation in the end.
It is.
I guess fitting for us to talk about here on Pi Day, Dave, right?
Yes. Hey, happy Dave, Pi Day. I forgot about that.
Happy Pi Day, yes. Dave, any new news on this ballot initiative to eliminate property taxes? I'm a little bit surprised we haven't heard a lot lately.
Not very much on it, but we do know that the North Dakota Association of Counties, North Dakota League of Cities have come out against it. Their comment is, you know, if you take away our property taxing authority, we'll have to go to the legislature with our hands out and hope that they will put the money forward for us to pay for police, for fire, for streets, roads, bridges, et cetera, that type of things that are paid for by property taxes. But it is part of a frustration about property taxes that a lot of it is driven by how much your house is valued. And that's your property taxes. You pay a percentage of that.
Dave, any new news on new candidates that have thrown their hat into the ring for any of the various races that we'll be voting on here soon?
Yeah, we have a new person that's from northern North Dakota who is going to be running now in the Republican primary. And it looks like they're going to skip the convention as well. And that's a congressional candidate. There has been a lot of support. And I should point this out because the Fedorchuk campaign, she's running for Congress as well. She's going to the convention. But if she doesn't get the nomination at the convention, she said she will go to the primary as well. But she's received 56 endorsements from North Dakota legislators. So she says, you know, that shows that she's got some strength when they get to the convention endorsements.
Dave, what else is new relative to the upcoming primary and general elections? Anything else that we should be aware of?
I really am telling people to watch the Department of Public Instruction race because Kirsten Baszler is the incumbent. She goes to the conventions to get a letter of support because it's a non-party office. But there have been a number of candidates who have come out and said they want to be a candidate for DPI. That will be one to watch in the primary as well.
All right, Dave, any other news stories your group's working on?
As we said about the BSc and how that's going to fit into higher education, but I am going to be talking to some political science folks to talk about the dynamics of the race between Kelly Armstrong and Tammy Miller for governor. There's some interesting stuff there.
Dave, it's always a great pleasure for me to visit with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig. Appreciate it.
Shucks, you ain't making me. I has to go down the river.
I know, Huck.
Huckleberry Finn, that classic American character created by Mark Twain, travels with a man fleeing slavery. A new novel tells Jim's side of the story.
I'm writing the novel that Twain was not ill-equipped, but unequipped to create.
Percival Everett on his novel, James, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
4 a.m. Central to 9 a.m. Central here on Prairie Public.
There's the fanfare, and that means only one thing. It's time to go to the movies with our Matt Olien. Matt, how are you?
I'm good, Craig.
We're going to get to a summary, I guess, of the Oscars here in just a moment. But first, you have a movie to review, Cabrini. What do you think about it?
Well, so this is the time of year, Craig, that's very dry at theaters. So the Oscar stuff is siphoning out. We've had the Oscars. And Dune Part 2 is the big film of the year so far. There's more coming. We'll get into that another week. But the pipeline is pretty thin right now. So I went to see Cabrini. This is by Angel Studios. Now, Angel Studios is known for their religious movies, which clearly they've found an audience for movies like this. And this is their latest, which is, of course, a biopic on Italian nun Francesca Cabrini, who came to New York City and helped Italian immigrants who were living in squalor and poverty and everything, and they were discriminated against, much like the Irish had been several decades before that. And what she achieved was amazing. You'll have to go see the movie to see what I'm talking about or look her up on Wiki, but she eventually founded this series of hospitals and orphanages, and it was immense what she dreamed of that happened. She's wonderfully played by the Italian actress Cristiana Del Anna. This film was directed by Alejandro Gomez Monteverde, but I would say she deserves a better movie than this. It is slow and dull and lifeless a little bit. I mean, it's handsomely mounted. It looks good. The period detail is good. We have a couple big supporting performances. David Morse plays kind of the New York Catholic, you know, diocese head. John Lithgow plays the corrupt mayor of New York City, who she clashes with to try to get better conditions for the Italians. But it all looks good, but the pacing is so leaden. I mean, it's so slow, Craig, that it's the old Jack L. Warner from Warner Brothers Studios. He used to talk about, if my butt's squirming in my seat, there's something wrong with the movie. The pacing was so slow. I would say it's handsomely mounted, respectable, and a bit lifeless. But I do think it's geared toward, you know, Catholics especially, religious-minded audiences. And for that, I think they will enjoy it. I think the pacing will leave them wanting a little bit more. And I will say, from Angel Studios' perspective, I didn't feel that the film, you know, banged me over the head with the religious stuff that much. I mean, she's clearly an important person, and she was a frail woman, a sickly woman who lived a long time and achieved a lot. But it doesn't really bang you over the head. I don't think it was overly religious. It's a presentation of her life and what she did. So for that, I'll give them a lot of credit. But it just needed a quicker pacing and a little more care to detail.
Too bad, because the story really sounds good to me, Matt. And I guess before we move on to the Oscar reviews here, did you come away with a sense of what it was to be Italian and discriminated against in the time in New York City?
I think that's the most important thing in the movie is, A, reminding people that this woman was canonized later as a saint. And I think she just deserves a better biopic. She deserves a better movie because she's a very important person. But yes, I think it shines a light on what do we kind of think of, Craig, when we think of Italian immigrants at that time. We think of the mafia, Godfather, Godfather 2. A lot of Italians kind of ended up in the mafia, which was kind of brought over from Sicily and Italy. But there were many hardworking Italian Americans who did not do that. They were hardworking people, and they were discriminated against. And I didn't, I guess, realize the level of discrimination that was going on in New York City among Italian immigrants. So it does shine a light on that, Craig. That's a good point.
All right, Matt, the Oscars were last Sunday. First of all, did you like the presentation of the show?
I liked that they started an hour earlier. Got done at 9:30 p.m. Central. That's a record. I've never, ever been done with the Oscars at 9:30 p.m. Central. Yeah, I think Jimmy Kimmel is fine. You know, Oscar hosting is a tricky gig. Chris Rock got slapped 2 years ago. It can be a dangerous gig. I thought that the Ryan Gosling Ken number was great. I thought the Arnold Schwarzenegger Danny DeVito appearance was hilarious. Hilarious as they poked fun at Michael Keaton, you know, out in the audience as Batman.
I've seen so many memes now from that. Oh, geez.
Yep. I would say, in terms of the awards, I had Oppenheimer winning 8. It got 7.
You were
so
real close there.
I was real close. Zone of Interest beat it for Best Sound, which I thought was going to be a tight vote. But I think the interesting thing was how good Poor Things did. So early in the night, it won in succession production design, costume, and makeup. I did think it would win production design. I thought Barbie would get costume. And when it won those three, I texted two movie friends and I said, big night for Poor Things. Does this mean Emma Stone pulls the upset? What you're looking for is trends, Craig. Just like with an electoral college map, you're looking for trends. And the trend was Oscar voters really like Poor Things. And I liked it too. And sure enough, when Emma Stone won, that was the one surprise of the night, because I think people thought Lily Gladstone would win for Killers of the Flower Moon, which culturally would have been an amazing moment. But as I've said, Craig, I think Martin Scorsese didn't do Lily Gladstone any favors. She needed about one or two more big scenes in that movie. She plays second fiddle to Leonardo DiCaprio's moronic, earnest character, which I thought was a problem with the movie. I think Poor Things is a better movie. Emma Stone is that movie. It is on her shoulders. It's a magnificent performance. I wish there could have been a tie, but clearly the voters were not wild about Killers of the Flower Moon. Its momentum stalled a long time ago. And a lot of other films did win one or two awards. That was nice to see Anatomy of a Fall get screenplay. Wonderful film. Devine Joy Randolph winning for The Holdover, supporting actress. But a big night for Oppenheimer. I think it'll go down as a really, really interesting and very good biopic film that benefited from Barbie to make all the money that it did.
It really did. And I thought that much of the to-do about that Barbenheimer, whatever you want to call it, was more about Barbie at the time than it was about Oppenheimer. But that allowed the movie to really gain momentum in my eyes.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of Barbie fans that are upset with just the one award. And that happens, that, you know, nobody's guaranteed an Oscar. They take a vote. You have a better chance to win Grammys because they have like 900 categories. But it was a tough year. There's a lot of strong films this year. And had Barbie been released last year or during one of the COVID years, I think it sweeps. I mean, because the last 3 years were weak compared to this year. So it got stuck in a tough year, tough competition. Ryan Gosling could have won the Oscar, but it turns out to be Robert Downey's night.
Matt, will there be any fallout maybe this summer, this coming winter, from the strike that we had that maybe will have slowed productions of things we probably would have seen this summer, but now we're going to have to see later?
Good question. I think I think we're going to be okay with that. I think that the COVID years are now in the rearview mirror. We had 3 years, as I said, 2020, 21, 22, where I thought that the film years were weak. I don't think Everything Everywhere All at Once would have beat Barbie. If Barbie was released last year, I think it wins Best Picture. It's as simple as that. I think there's 5 or 6 movies this year that would have beat Everything Everywhere All at Once for Best Picture last year. Looking ahead, I think that the strike, it went on for a while, but I think it ended soon enough where we're going to have another strong year in the pipeline, and we'll talk about that in a few weeks. But Dune Part 2 has the year off to a strong start. We're just kind of in that weird period now, but I do expect another big year. Maybe not as strong as 23. It's hard to put the Barbenheimer thing, genie in a bottle, twice, but we'll see what happens.
What are we going to hear from you about next week, Matt?
Probably One Life with Anthony Hopkins as a British man who saved a bunch of Jewish kids during the Holocaust in World War II.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. Dakota Datebook is next. Stay with us.
The Dakota Prairie Regional Center for the Arts in New Rockford, North Dakota presents their spring show, Church Basement Ladies, a musical comedy celebrating the church basement kitchen culture. Performances are Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, April 1st through May 1st at 2:30 and 7:30 p.m. A traditional church basement dinner is available prior to the show. Tickets are available at dprca.com or by calling 701-947-2174.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 14th. Dakota Territory began the work of organizing counties in 1861. Pembina was the first official county, established in 1867. Some North Dakota counties remain in their original form. Others were carved up. The southern portion of Hettinger County, for example, became Adams County. And the Bowman County story is interesting. Created in 1883, it was eliminated in 1903 due to a lack of settlement, but then reestablished in 1907. In 1902, there was a move to consolidate Allred, Wallace, and McKenzie counties. The territory was located near Medora, so supporters of the new county proposed the name of Roosevelt County. To form the new county, organizers had to get 150 registered voters to sign the petition. Following that, a majority of the voters in the three affected counties had to vote in favor of the new county. If that happened, the new county would be approved as long as there were at least 1,000 legitimate residents. The campaign heated up as signatures were collected. W.H. Denny, a banker from Williston, traveled to the capital to deliver petitions containing several hundred names of citizens who favored consolidation. On this date in 1903, those petitions sat on a desk in Bismarck, waiting for a review. The effort to form Roosevelt County was not well received. Many people thought the new county would result in higher taxes. By June, it seemed like the new county was doomed. North Dakota newspapers received a tongue-in-cheek obituary for the Roosevelt County organization. The notice announced funeral services for June 10, 1904. The service was to be held on the banks of the Missouri River. All friends of the organization were invited. It was requested that no flowers be sent. One wit in Dickinson wrote a letter of condolence to the Dickinson Press expressing his sympathy. He hoped the balm of Gilead would be sprinkled over your torn and bleeding heart and heal the sores if it cannot remove the scars. The obituary seemed to be a bit premature. The subject arose again in 1908 when petitions were once again circulated in favor of Roosevelt County. Promoters urged all registered voters to sign the petitions, but in the end, nothing came of the effort. There is still no Roosevelt County in North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow in this time slot at 3 p.m. Central,
it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. And at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. Coming up Monday on Main Street, we'll visit with Catherine Gray. Her movie, Show Her the Money, addresses a real issue of women getting less than 2% of venture capital. The movie also demystifies what venture capital is. Show Her the Money reminds us that money is power, and women need it to achieve true equity. Gray's film will be screened next Tuesday at the Fargo Film Festival at 7 p.m. in Theater 1 at the Fargo Theater. Also on Monday, if you're a senior and wanting to re-enter the job market, but not sure if you have the skills needed, the Senior Community Service Employment Program can help. And we'll visit with one of the program's participants, Veronica Crawford. We hope you can join us again Monday on Main Street.